What is Maine? Who is Maine? What are the stories of those who have lived here from the beginning, that migrated here, and that continue to inhabit this unique place? These are conversations from the Pointed Firs, invoking the spirit of place with artists and authors from Maine.
Welcome to Conversations from the Pointed Firs. I'm your host, Peter Neal. My guest today is Claire Aykroyd, author of Murder in the Maple Woods, her first novel, a detective story set in the sugar camps in the northern forests of Maine, published in cooperation with Maine Authors Publishing, and a finalist in the 2021 Maine Literary Awards. She's a landscape designer, teacher, and for many years has been studying the history of production and conducting certifications of organic maple syrup in Maine. Claire, welcome.
Thank you.
So, in our conversations leading up to this, you've presented a kind of faceted personality. It's been really interesting to try to figure out who you are and what your life has been like here and elsewhere. Why don't we begin there? How did you find your way to down East Maine?
Oh, that's a good question. The easy answer is that I was in the middle of a graduate program in Maryland, having finished a bachelor's degree in England and wanted to stay in school because it was easier than getting a job. And I just followed a friend up to Maine. And then, long story, I had visa problems. And fast forward 3 years, I am set down roots in Maine. And I've been here ever since. That was in 1976, I think. So people say, you're not from here, are you? And I say, no, I'm not. But I've been here a lot longer than a lot of people.
Well, tell me how you filled that time. Where do you live? How do you live?
Well, okay, so the visa problem has a lot to do with it, because I, for years, had visa issues, which are neither here nor there, but I couldn't get a job. So being an English person who grew up gardening, I just started doing under-the-table garden work for friends and neighbors in Orono, which is where I'd sort of landed. And the next thing I knew I had a business, a landscape business, in Orono. It was a multifaceted landscaping business and nursery called The Growing Concern, which had a good life for a short time, the mediumly good life for a slightly longer time. And that was it. I eventually got a visa, started a family, owned a home, and I've been here ever since. I've loved living in Orono all that time.
Well, tell me about how you got into the maple syrup certification business, not the most ubiquitous profession.
No, well, it's a good story. It's a nice thing. The business that I had was awfully hard work, and I expect anybody who's tried to run a seasonal business in Maine will know that it is tough sledding, and I wasn't really making money, and I got tired of writing paychecks to people who were making more money than I was. And I did some creative thinking and got some really good help and sort of gave up The Growing Concern. For what it's worth, it still exists in its component parts. I kind of gave away the bits of the business to other people, and I stayed in my home, and I needed an income. And at that point, I knew people at the university who were involved in the sort of early stages of organic certification and organic production. In the 70s, it was 80s. It was a new idea, really, that you could be profitable and successful and not just fringy doing organic food production. And I became an inspector for MOFCA way back then, which at that time was a fairly informal job. Fast forward.
MOFCA, the Maine Farmers.
Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association.
And you were hired by them? And
I was hired by them, I think always on a contract basis. I can't remember. Mm-hmm. I am now an independent contract inspector. I'm not on the payroll. So you fast forward a while. I mean, for years, I did farm inspections for organic certification. The organic certification business got taken over by the USDA and became a national program. MOFCA has become the main accredited agency for organic certification in Maine, and I continued as an inspector. And then something on the order of 15 years ago. I meant to look up the date, probably a little bit sooner than that. Big maple syrup production facilities on the northwest edge of the state were looking into getting their syrup certified under American standards. There is a premium on a pound for certified organic syrup. And MAFCA was looking for people to do those inspections. And it's not an easy job to fill, I think. I think it goes on being a challenge because we'll get into this. I hope those camps, those big sugar camps, are extraordinarily remote. They are off the grid. There's no way into them in Maine, from Maine, in the maple season, realistically. The producers and access to them are all from Canada. So you've got to be somebody who's willing and able to have the time to go and spend several days at a time staying in Canada, crossing the border daily into those camps. The geography of it is really interesting. So anyway, that was necessary. You needed to know how to, you know, you needed to be a person who could sort of work under tough remote conditions independently.
Let's go back a little bit further. This is, I mean, it's just amazing. First of all, let me admit my ignorance. Right up front, I knew nothing about this whatsoever. Let's start all the way back in the beginning. Why is there a stand of maple trees that expand across this particular part of the state of Maine at the border? Is there a particular condition? Why is it there?
Yes. The full answer to that, you need to be more of a geologist than I am. I have a sketchy knowledge. The short answer is that an awful lot of Maine has poor acidic soils. It's the result of the geographical history of the state. And sugar maples require a more fertile, higher pH, more calcium soils. And so those typically are not on the old igneous rocks that form the Appalachian chain or up to Katahdin, but there is a series of ridges of what I think are metamorphic or possibly sedimentary rocks, again, don't quote me on that, that run across the border, sort of from Jackman on up. Along that piece of Maine, there are conditions which are well-drained, moist slopes of relatively fertile, higher pH soils that support the maple, yellow birch, beech forest, which is a ecotype of its own, and that's where they are.
What's the scale of area here? What are we talking about?
Oh, God, I don't think I even know. If you think of Jackman, if you can get, anybody listening can get Jackman in their head, go north up the, you go northeast up that jaggedy edge of Maine, which is the border with Quebec, and I think you can probably go about 200 miles up that line, up to probably further than that. If you go all the way up to Clayton Lake, is probably a couple of hundred miles. Anyway, that's where those trees are. They're all over that bit. And then, of course, extending all west, north and west into Canada.
Canada
makes infinitely more syrup than America does. Mm-hmm. They've got huge stands of sugar maples that expand all the way across. But our best bit is that piece of Maine and then across Vermont, where there are the conditions that support the maple forest.
I love in your book, we'll get to the book in a minute, but in the book or and in our conversations, you've talked about something called the Golden Road. It's like the airline.
You know, only better.
Yeah. Well, there you go. One goes east, west. One goes north and south. They're like mythical pathways.
It is. It's fantastic. The Golden Road is amazing. Golden Road basically goes from Millinocket to Saint Zachary. Did I get that right? Saint Orley. Damn. You'd think I'd know. Anyway, it goes all the way across Maine. It's about 100 miles, and it's 100 miles of dirt road. It is a privately owned logging road. There's all sorts of agreements with the state, and which I don't understand or know about, that permit traffic on that road. But it is a dirt road that runs right across the middle of Maine, and it's about 100 miles. And you know, it is, it's a mythical road. It's the most fabulous drive if you've got good tires and an extra bit of gas in the tank, because it really is 100 miles with nowhere to stop, nowhere to shop, nowhere to you know, do anything except take photographs and look at moose. It's marvelous. But you are indeed out beyond the reach of help. It is a truly remote, amazing road.
So are there, the traffic is timber trucks?
Yes, and you're always warned to watch out. Timber trucks and hunting season, a lot of pickup trucks. Yeah, it's big timber trucks hauling logs.
Right.
And they own the road, and they do quite literally own the road. And you need to watch out.
Yeah. The scale of it always, it just amazes me because, you know, we sit down here in our little conclave along the coast and we think we have the vastness of the ocean, but there's this thing behind the coast.
Tell me about it.
This enormous.
Enormous. And one of the things that sort of gets my back up is the idea, the notion, the sort of almost a prejudice that what is Maine is the coast, and it's nearly always the coast. But the prejudiced assumption that is all that Maine has to offer, I have a chip on my shoulder about that. And you can talk to people who've spent summers in Maine for decades, and they have never wanted to go up and see what the rest of Maine has to offer. And half of me thinks, well, that's fine. You stay down there and on the coast and leave the woods alone. And the other half of me thinks, you're missing the most remarkable expanse of natural forest that still exists in the northeast of America.
Yeah. So here you are, you're young, you're hired by Mafka.
Wasn't that young?
Well, you're forever young. And you're sent up there into this place, you drive the Golden Road. What do you find?
Well, actually, we don't drive the Golden Road because the geography is interesting. You go up to Jackman, cross into Jackman, from Jackman into Quebec at Armstrong, the big Armstrong crossing in St. George, and stay in St. George. And then, you know, to do these inspections, we stay in Canada and cross over every day into the camps. So, yes, we do. I've driven back down the Golden Road instead of going all the way back around and back down through Jackman. But so getting up there is relatively simple. And then getting into the camps is the challenge. They're little crossings. The two that we do, the main ones, are little towns called Saint Zachary and Saint Aurélie. And they are tiny crossings on the border there. On the west side of that line, the Canadian side, there are back-to-back little towns, amazing little communities. They mostly have a large church. It's mostly Catholic populations. Large church, nice grocery stores, tidy houses, small farms. And it's quite a populated and busy community. As soon as you cross the border, it's nothing but woods. It's a remarkable thing how hard a line that is between timberlands and farmland, inhabited small town farmland. So anyway, we stay there and then we go across every day and you cross these little border crossings, which is just a couple of sheds. One shed on the American side and another shed on the Canadian side.
With customs?
With the customs. One guy on duty, you know, and you cross over, you say what you're doing. The border crossings are great. the border guards, especially on the American side, act as a sort of bush telegraph. They will tell you which camp operators are in, who went out to get spare parts, who came in with food, you know, what trucks have broken down. They are the one source of information. They're often the only place you can get good cell phone reception. So we that is Mafka, posts the schedule for inspections at the border crossings. And then everybody, it's sort of the best way to let everybody know, because often contacting the producers can be very hard. They live in Quebec, really live in Quebec, when they're not working in their camps. When they're in the camps and you need to get hold of them, they can be very hard to get a hold of. So the border crossing stations act as a sort of message board. I bet one of the delights of having written this book and got involved in this is that I've had an excuse to meet and talk to people, forest rangers, game wardens, border crossing people, state troopers, police chiefs, who know that area, foresters. And the people who are there and stay there are there because they would rather be there. It's like, I don't want to go live where there's a whole bunch of people. I'm happy up in the woods. You know, the people who've raised a family right up in those woods, there's one or two places where people actually live and don't just come in for the season of logging or syruping or hunting. And they'd rather have it that way.
Mm-hmm.
I think quite possibly raising a family gets tough. You know, I've been told so many stories, but I think that it's not an unfamiliar population of people who live in Maine who'd rather be in the woods than not.
Let's go back to the beginning of this phenomenon, 19th century, I assume, well, where it becomes into a kind of industry. The owners, are they American or are they Canadian?
Well, that's one of the anomalies of that whole area there. And it's very interesting and it's quite strange. It takes a little while to understand. The land is all owned not by the syrup producers. And to the best of my knowledge, a little bit obscure, and people scratch their heads and go, oh, I don't really know. I think most of the land now is owned by big investment companies, mm-hmm. to our eternal dismay and detriment.
And who bought that land simply because it was timber and
timber
it was a
investment,
big open
it's investment land, mm-hmm. you know, and right. It's like, you kind of hate that, at least I do. My local back gets put up. But anyway, that is what it is. And then there are land management companies. And again, I don't want to be wrong about this, but I think it's true to say that companies like Wagner, Landvest, possibly Seven Islands and more, are more management companies than owners. And they are the people that the producers, the syrup producers, deal with.
My guest today on Conversation from the Pointed Firs is Claire Ackroyd, novelist, landscape designer, and uniquely employed to visit, inspect, and certify one of Maine's most iconic products, maple syrup. Not just any syrup, but produced under certain conditions, regulations, and certifications that guarantee the unique consistency and quality of a food enjoyed worldwide as an expression of the spirit of Maine. The program is Conversations from the Pointed Firs, a monthly interview program, the first Friday every month here on WERU Community Radio, Blue Hill, Maine.
So the syrup producers own their camps. This is just like a hunting camp. You don't own the land, you own the camp.
So it's a lease, almost.
It's on a lease.
Yeah.
But they don't own, you know, that's fairly easy to understand. You own your building, you don't own the land underneath it. You have a lease for the land. Just like a camp. The trees, which might extend over hundreds of acres, are also leased. The producers pay a per-tap fee back to the land management companies. And they don't own and they don't control the forest, which puts a lot of very strange tensions and challenges to the whole business. But anyway, the short answer is, they don't own the trees. They pay a lease, a per-tap lease.
Let's say a lease just of a certain size is 5,000 taps, 20,000 taps.
No. 60,000, 80,000. Mm-hmm. I struggled to come up with an average. You walk into a camp and you find they're tapping 20 or 30,000 trees. It's probably a two-person job. And then you get up to the big camps that are tapping maybe 80,000 trees, which is not unusual. There are some bigger ones than that. And they have more typically a sort of workforce, you know, a bunch of young guys who got together and can make a big operation like that work. And I suspect that as with most sort of natural resource-based businesses, these smaller ones fall away and get amalgamated. And so if your neighbor with 20,000 taps gets out of the business, ages out, gives it up, those trees are likely to be taken over by a neighbor rather than continue as a 20,000 tap. I think I'm not, you know, I'm an anecdotal but not totally accurate, you know, reporter on that business. That's what I know from observing.
The people that actually are tapping and collecting the syrup and boiling the syrup and making the product, are they Canadians?
Well, when I started doing this, and I think, again, I look back, it's easily 15 years, might be more than that. And I was fairly new in there. Other people had been doing inspections on a very small scale before that, but they started ramping up in about 2010. At that time, mm-hmm. almost all of the camps were Francophone Quebecois families, and the camps were all up along quite close to the border. Some of them further in, there are one or two anomalous ones further down the Golden Road, and you can go up and down from the Golden Road and the Baker Road into more remote places. But they were nearly all family-sized businesses close to the border, run by French-speaking Canadians. And if you go now, you know, 15, 20 years later, there are more, I think, that I can certainly think of four or five quite large camps, some of them quite new, that are owned and run by Americans, and they are accessible from Maine. You don't have to go into Canada to get to them. So that's either a question of improving roads or finding untapped trees that were available or taking over a camp. I think it's probably mostly newer camps. I don't want to be wrong about this. There's a great big new one up in the north on all on new trees, which is an all-American owned business. And that you can only get to from Canada. I think with, I don't know, better vehicles, you know, more money in it or something. There have been some large camps opened up on that general area, the sort of northern Somerset County, that are not the traditional French-Canadian producers.
I'm seeing a workforce that is mostly Quebecois, but then also now has Americans. You have to come in from Canada, although now some can come directly. You have to go through a passport control. The harvest, the resource is there. It's boiled down. It's picked up. Is it then all taken back into Canada?
No. And here's a question. I keep, possibly when I go home, I will actually research this. The syrup is all American syrup.
Yeah.
There's one odd exception, but leaving him out of it, the syrup is produced and almost all of it is put into big barrels. It always used to be 55-gallon barrels, and the stainless steel barrels that are popular now and coming in are slightly smaller than that. A huge percentage, I mean, I can't tell you what percentage, but it looks to me like, you know, 90, 95% of all of that syrup is bought by two big wholesale buyers, one in New Hampshire and one in Vermont. And they come in when the roads are dry, in the summer, I suppose. I'm never quite sure when they pick it up, but after the mud season has passed, come in with big trucks and take that syrup back down to the big reprocessing, wholesale buyer reprocessing facilities that we don't have in Maine. And one of the things that, again, you know, given infinite amount of time, I would answer all these questions, but I don't know why we don't have a big operation like that in Maine. There are some. There are one or two producers who are rebottling, reprocessing their own syrup and selling it directly into Maine. The Passamaquoddy is one group. They've got a bottling facility in Moose River, and they're doing a fabulous job there. And there are one or two other smaller and or mid-sized producers that are keeping their syrup in Maine, bringing it down and rebottling it, but nothing like the huge facilities that most of that syrup goes out to. And then it's not sold as Maine syrup. Maine gets no credit for it. And we don't get the added value of the reprocessing, which is a crime.
So this was, of course, the story for a long time with lobster. Lobster would be harvested in Maine waters. The market was limited. The excess would go to Canada. It would be processed in Canada because we had no processors. And then it would be canned, and it would be sold as a product of Canada, not as a product of the USA.
Right.
So that we have something similar here, where the product is generated on the as American syrup. It's branded as Maine organic syrup. It goes out to these distributors, neither one of which is in the state,
right,
and is then sold, perhaps it's sold back into Maine, branded as Maine or elsewhere?
I don't know that. I think it's probably sold as American. I don't know. You know, again, I don't have to know in order to do my job. And when I get home, I forget that this is something I was going to look up, and I don't really know who would answer the questions. But I assume that if the syrup is rebottled in New Hampshire, it's not sold as Maine syrup. I don't know whether it can be sold as New Hampshire syrup. Probably not. I suspect that it is sold. I don't want to insult anybody's production here. I think that it's probably just sold as American syrup,
right,
made in America.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. I'm sure it's not sold as Maine syrup.
is baffling to me.
Well, it's a tragedy, you know. It's sad more than anything.
Well, yes, it is sad that we haven't been able to essentially control our own production, to find a way to, I mean, the people in New Hampshire, of course, and Vermont are buying from other places as well. They're buying from New Hampshire and Vermont
and Maine.
So they've got the economy of scale.
Yes.
And doing it. I think it's really interesting that the Passamaquoddy are doing it. Fascinating business opportunity, which they've
yes.
taken advantage
and they're taking that very seriously.
Yeah.
And they're doing a lovely job. You know, they're quite new. The last time I inspected their camps, they were still hauling themselves up by their bootstraps, trying to get everything. You know, it's a huge process to build the camp, the tapping lines, the vacuum systems, the concentrators, the reverse osmosis concentrators, the big boilers, the bottling, the canning. You know, I mean, the whole thing is enormous.
It's a massive capital
investment, yeah. and requires huge amounts of labor to get it all running. And you will hear people say nobody wants to come and do that kind of work up in the woods. But they are doing it. They're doing it, and they're doing it beautifully.
So I have 50,000 taps. They're all linked into a kind of hose complex that's strung through the trees.
Yes.
Gravity-driven?
No, vacuumed.
Vacuum-driven.
Oh, yeah, it's all on vacuum.
And so as the sap rises, and every day is different in terms of how that works, temperature and conditions.
Yes.
It then comes out of the tap, is sucked down, how long? 200 yards?
Oh, no,
half a mile?
No, that's some of the really cool stuff. I have been on a snowmobile, I want to say 2 miles, maybe 3 miles, probably even 5 miles, away from the sugar camp. There are substations, right? If you've got a nice stand of trees that's a mile away from your camp, you're likely to put a pump station and the collection tanks out in the woods there somewhere, and you have a generator, and you're running a vacuum pump and a big collection tanks. And when those big tanks are full, that one way or the other, you get that sap back to the main camp. Typically, it's a big line. You know, it's much bigger than the collection lines. It's a distribution line that it just runs right back to camp, and you drive up some sort of bumpy track alongside one of these big feeder lines that's bringing sap back from a remote pump station back down to the sugar house.
So when you come to inspect, what are you looking at?
Ah, good question. One of the things that I wanted to do when I wrote the book was to answer questions once and for all. There's questions I got from sort of know-it-all people in the bar that wanted to tell me that there was no reason to certify organic maple syrup because it's naturally organic. And the answer is yes. It is naturally organic, and it will be organic unless you screw it up. So a lot of what we do is to make sure that it is not getting contaminated. But there's an underlying principle, which I think is important to understand, is that the underlying basic concept of organic production is not so much the absence or presence of pesticides. That is the end product of husbandry systems which are designed and researched and managed to produce food, you know, fish, beef, corn, scallops, maple syrup, blueberries, whatever, without degrading the resource from which it is produced. We're not polluting rivers, we're not fouling the air, we're not destroying soils, and we're not destroying the forest. So, with that in mind, the standards for maple syrup production, for the organic standards, which interestingly haven't yet been don't get into that. It's a state by state program still. But anyway, it all aligns with the national program. And the sort of first piece of an inspection is looking at the forest. There are tapping standards, and those regulate the size of the taps, the number of taps per tree, the size of the tree that is tapped, the health of the tree that is tapped, the health of the forest that is being exploited, the placement of the taps, how soon the taps are removed after the last run of sap. What else? Those are all standards aimed at producing syrup in a sustainable manner without destroying the forest that it's being produced from. The idea that you can tap a tree and do it no harm is not true. Punching holes in trees will naturally cause a wound in the tree. So the goal is to do it in a way that does sustainable damage.
So this sap is coming down through this system of pipes. They're plastic, they're flexible.
Plastic lines, yes.
Mm-hmm. It all comes down into an enormous vat.
Into big vats that is then pumped. The next stage, the next bit of the inspection process is to make sure that you are avoiding contamination. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of different ways that you can contaminate the sap before it gets into its closed barrels. There used to be a habit of putting formaldehyde plugs into the trees to stop the formation of bacteria. So your sap came nicely laced with formaldehyde, which is a highly allergenic thing for some, you know. Yeah. So anyway, we look at making sure that diesel fumes of the generators aren't getting into the sap, that the diesel generator is running somewhere separated from the sap tanks, or the sap tanks are closed, that anything that's used to clean lines or tanks or filter systems is in accordance with organic standards and is sufficiently rinsed, and that the defoamers used are organic defoamers, that the containers that the syrup is packed into clean. And that's a whole inspection process. And then the last bit are audits to make sure that the amount that is being produced correlates to the amount that is sold and is reasonable for the number of trees that are being tapped, so that there's no suggestion that you are cheating.
Right. Is there a spreadsheet? Every tree has a number?
Every tree has a spot on a map.
Amazing. Fascinating.
It is fascinating. So one of the things that was about the anomalous ownership situation is that because the land management companies charge these producers per tap fees, everybody is very concerned that the tap count is correct. The producers don't want to be paying a fee for taps that they haven't got. And the land management companies who are collecting the money want to be collecting money for as many taps as there are. It really means that the organic inspector doesn't have to do a count because that's been done. We sort of trust that the we look at their tap lines and their counts and their systems, maps and records, but we also know that the land management people have been checking the tap counts.
If you have a good year or a bad year, the amount of money you pay to the land management company is the same. You don't. They don't take any upside if all of a sudden you have a banner year.
So no, mm-hmm. That is true, and that means that, you know, you do the math. $1.35 a tap on 80,000 taps. That's a pantload of money.
Yeah.
And so if you have a poor year, all of your money can go to paying your lease fee.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't get into the economics of it. It's not my business. We ask to see their bottom line receipts. And, you know, over the years, you get into some very interesting conversations with people about the economics of it. But I don't think anybody's getting rich up there.
Yeah, you would think that. And, of course, at the same time, the management companies with the tap fees are in the classic situation of exploiters, where they have to run this fine line between profit or the destruction of the source of revenue.
Well, I would love to spend more time. I got too many things to do. The more I learn, the more interested I get. The situation in the maple forests, I think it is fair to say, and I've picked the brains of some retired friends at the university to straighten me out on this. The value of the syrup, the sort of annual yield from syrup, is better than you would get from sustainable harvesting. But if you clear cut a stand, and maple, nice quality maple, is a very high value product. And I, as far as I can understand, it all goes for furniture, pool cues, mm-hmm. skateboards, mm-hmm. flooring, mm-hmm. A lot of flooring, decking, all sorts of, you know, boat, no, not boat decking. Where did I read? Oh, I know, bowling alleys. Mm-hmm. It's a very hard product that doesn't warp. You know, it's beautiful timber, mm-hmm. beautiful furniture wood. If you clear cut a stand, you get a huge amount of money, huge amount of money. I mean, I wrote down some numbers. But you have destroyed the resource. However, the amount of money you get invested at whatever percent investment is will carry you through enough years that you don't care anymore. You know, you can make more money off that money invested per year for the next 20 years than you would on either sustainable harvesting or maple syrup production. And, you know, if I could wave a magic wand, that would be completely non-allowed. It's like, no, leave, don't, you're destroying the most, even if we can stop people wanting to, you know, replace their flooring, the concept of destroying the source of this magical natural sweetener, it absolutely breaks my heart, because sugar production, cane sugar production, is one of the most environmentally damaging and humanly exploitative products that the world knows. So let's do all the other things that we can to produce sweeteners. And who doesn't love a lovely sweetener? And maple syrup can be produced endlessly, sustainably, as long as global warming and soil acidification doesn't kill the maples. We can go on extracting sugar from these forests. And that, to me, at the same time that you're maintaining, you know, an environment that yields shootable game and camping sites and clean water and, you know, recreation and clean air and carbon sequestration, all of that. And I mean, it seems obvious to me. I am aware that there are arguments on the other side, you know, that you can clear cut pieces of forest and they will regenerate and that. But it doesn't seem to me to be true for maples, because they regenerate very, very slowly. The growth rate for maples, first of all, I think it's slowing down, largely due to climate change and soil acidification. And I am not an expert on that. That's sort of a superficial view. But they regenerate slowly. They do regenerate, but you get some soil loss if you clear cut, and 40 years minimum, more like 100, before you got a stand of maples back that was usable. And you're likely to get all sorts of opportunistic stuff that comes in before that that is useless, and so on. And so you might be able to turn over spruce fir stands on a fairly rapid basis. The turnover rate is something on the order of 40 years. But I don't think that's true of the maples. And anyway, they have so many other values.
My guest today on Conversations from the Pointed Firs is Claire Ackroyd, novelist, landscape designer, and uniquely employed to visit, inspect, and certify one of Maine's most iconic products, maple syrup. Not just any syrup, but produced under certain conditions, regulations, and certifications that guarantee the unique consistency and quality of a food enjoyed worldwide as an expression of the spirit of Maine. The program is Conversations from the Pointed Firs, a monthly interview program, the first Friday every month here on WERU Community Radio, Blue Hill, Maine.
You know, I feel like one of the things I hate, and I took the opportunity in my book to use pit bulls as the poster children for the idea that you shouldn't have an opinion until you have enough information. And I feel like my opinion might be improved with more information. Yeah. But it's very hard not to have a gut reaction to seeing maple logs being hauled down the Golden Road and thinking, there goes the syrup.
Yep. Now you've inspected the taps, you've inspected the system, the collection system, you've inspected the processing. It's now all in these stainless steel 50-gallon drums. It's taken away to someplace and comes back. Or doesn't. When you go into a store here in Maine and you go to the maple syrup department and you can see that there are all these bottles of maple syrup, can you tell which one of those bottles is actually produced in Maine?
100%. 100%.
How do you do that?
Because it's on the label.
The label says,
if it's organic, the organic labeling is very, very specific. You have to have the three parts of an organic label. I only buy organic syrup because I know they're coming from the people that I know. No, that's not true. I buy syrup from small producers. Nearly everybody labels their syrup because they want it to be known. There are lots and lots and lots of very interesting and very cool small producers in the southern area, you know, around Skowhegan and all around there, who are making beautiful syrup on a much smaller basis, some of them quite large basis. Some of them, the majority of the small ones, are not certified organic. They don't need to be. You know, if you know your farmer, if you know the guy growing radishes at the farmer's market, you don't particularly mind if he's organic certified or not. You know who he or she is, and you think, I want that person's radishes or bread or cookies or whatever the hell. So the labeling, I'm sure all those people label their syrup. I mean, there's a lot of maple syrup producers in Maine, small basis, and I can find their syrup anyway. But the bigger ones that are, they mostly sell from their own stores or online or just locally in the local shops. The bigger producers, the organic producers, you can go into the co-ops and the natural food stores and you can find organic syrup, and it will say the producer's name and the address, and it has to have an ingredient statement which says organic maple syrup, and then it has to have the producer's identification, name and location, and you've got to be able to identify the producer. And then it says certified organic by, in our case, Mofka. So you can tell exactly where it came from. And they will have a lot number on it, because one of the things that we do, every bottle has a lot number, is to pick up a bottle or go to a 55-gallon drum and take its lot number, it's all got to be labeled and lot numbered, and trace that back to the day of production.
I will never look at a bottle of maple syrup at my Sunday morning pancakes soaked in syrup and butter without thinking of you. Because you're the person who's guaranteeing this. You're out there in the middle of nowhere. We rely on you entirely to certify and to make sure that all these standards and regulations are maintained.
You're
on the front line of the maple syrup.
I hope you're right in thinking that, because I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't think that there was real integrity to the process.
Right.
And I really do believe that, not just in maple syrup. There are problems in the organic certification world which are well known and much too much talked about. But on the scale that I do inspections, I think that it is a genuinely valuable process. It tells the buyer that this product has been produced in a way that is environmentally friendly, is healthy and clean, and has been done in a manner that is not harmful to the ground it was produced on or the person consuming it. And I will stand by that.
I have two questions about the cultural implications of all this. One is that when you buy something that's labeled the way you described, and you're essentially accepting the trust that's built into the process. I trust the process. And what it is doing, though, is creating a product that is identified culturally with our state, with the state of Maine. It becomes a product, like a lobster is a product, image, an icon of the culture of the state we live in. So there is this kind of cultural implication to it that contributes to the idea that the spirit of Maine is about nature and purity and consistency and resolution and all these kinds of qualities of life that are associated with some of the things that we take great pride in as citizens of the place where we live.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think, you know, just to go back to the non-certified organic, I wouldn't want anybody to think that syrup that is not certified organic is not good syrup. That would be a terrible misconception, because the small producers who don't need to be certified organic and who would find the record-keeping process onerous and unnecessary are quite possibly producing syrup in an even more caring and sustainable manner than the big producers, because these are people with 20, 30, 100 acres of maple trees that they have looked after for generations and have been tapping. You know, it was grandpa with a couple of buckets, and it's now vacuum lines and a stainless steel boiler. But this is equally iconic and marvelous stuff. I mean, I can think of several very small producers who produce, you know, 50 gallons of syrup in a year. And it's just as magical and just as marvelous. But I think the value of the organic certification process is where it's these great big producers that you don't know. It's not the guy next door tapping sap and having you over for a cup of coffee laced with a seasoned syrup. It's not that. It's these big producers. And those are the people that you need us, the certification process, to come between you and that syrup so that you know that it too has been produced in a sustainable and healthy manner.
Do you taste the syrup?
Oh, always.
Can you taste the difference?
Oh, yes. I love this.
Appellation contrôlée.
Yeah, no. Well, you can't taste the difference in organic or non-organic. The question of the grades of syrup is a really, really good one. And you can get into knockdown, drag-out fights with people who claim that the dark syrup is better than the light syrup. And I've tasted syrup that is so pale you can see right through it. The golden, which is the palest, and then the dark or very dark robust. So I am here to say it is not a question of better than, it is a question of different. I think my genius, I will let the world have my analysis here, is that the way to see the difference between the light and the dark syrups is like looking at champagne against a robust Burgundy wine or a good stout. Both wonderful, serve different purposes. I think the very, very clear, and I can get into why they're different, but the clear, light, golden or amber, to me, is just mind-bendingly delicious. You could drink it. You taste all the different little flavors. You can taste nut and vanilla and subtle tastes in that syrup. And that's what you want to pour over your pancakes. If you're making a massive pot of beans and you've thrown salt pork and onions in there and you want to zhuzh it up with some syrup, then you need a nice dark one to, you know, to stand up to the beans and the salt pork and the onions. And they have very different values. But I get quite cross with people who tell me that the dark syrup is better.
Well, we have. I was once participated in an olive oil tasting, and I walked in as a skeptic and saying, "Well, what's this all about?" So, and in fact, all of a sudden, I'm schooled in the sense that there are 20 olive oils, and not one of them tastes. And you can perceive the taste.
Drastically different flavors.
Flavors
and different uses. One for your salad, one for frying your zucchini in, one for making. Yes, exactly. Right.
That's one level of the culture. There's another level of the culture. Are there songs? Are there traditions?
I don't know. I'm sure in Canada there are. I don't know of a single maple syrup song in America, but there are wonderful traditions. I mean, I think this is an interesting part of the whole thing. And I did ask around a bit about this. The maple forest extends from, you know, New Brunswick across to Michigan, the northern forests, and there are stands of maples that are tappable. And then they run down south almost as far as Maryland if you go down the Appalachians. And all of those places have different traditions from the original indigenous cultures, language groups, tribes, whatever. And they all have their own stories about maple. It's been a sweetener that has been discovered and utilized as long as there's been people living in the forest.
Right.
And probably before that by, you know, gnats and raccoons. But there are strong traditions. I don't know about songs, poems, limericks. I should make up a limerick about maple syrup. But it certainly is a hugely powerful cultural thread. The French Canadians, you know, those that have come across the border, they're some of the oldest producers. Those camps up on the northwest edge of Maine. The people who are operating them now, if they're still in the same family, are into their third and fourth generations.
Right. Well, there's no more powerful cultural statement in Canada than the maple leaf. I mean, it's the national symbol.
It's the national symbol. I have driven across Canada, but never in a season when I was paying attention to the forest. But the maple forest, that hardwood forest type, extends across Quebec and Ontario a long way and probably goes further north than I realize. There's a big, that's why Canada has the bulk. It produces 85% of the world's syrup.
So we spent all this time talking about the industry and the history and all the rest of it. We haven't talked about your book.
New.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, so here you are. You have this experience. You decide you want to say something about it, and you choose to do two things. You choose first to write a book, and you choose the detective story model to do that. You've never written a book before. You've never written a detective story before. How did that all come to pass?
I was raised on murder mysteries. Mm. My grandmother bought every new Agatha Christie as they came out. Right.
237 of them.
Yes, I think I've read them all. My mother went to Oxford right after Dorothy Sayers, and I was raised on the Lord Peter Wimsey mysteries, modeled myself on Harriet Vane. So that's in my blood, that's in my DNA, and I don't think a story, I don't like romances, and I don't like, you know, white knuckle
thrillers.
I like a good story that teaches me something about something, a place, a culture, a food, a tribe, a family, a house, you know, something that is real and I can learn from. I love Tony Hillerman's books about the big Four Corners Navajo reservation and life on that. I felt, and it's my understanding that the tribes that he lived amongst and wrote about did not hate him. They thought he used them as a basis for his book with respect and knowledge and understanding. And so I'm driving around out there. It's always, ever since I was a kid and reading, you know, book that you'd learn something about some obscure, weird thing. And the knowledge of that thing is the key to solving the mystery, whatever it is. You know, why did Granny fall down the stairs? We'll find out by understanding something obscure. And I'm a botanist by training, and I always thought it would be fun to write a book where understanding the Linnaean binomial system of plant nomenclature would be how you solved a mystery. Mm-hmm. And I've got various ideas for that.
Great idea, by the way.
Isn't that a good idea?
Very good idea.
The better idea, or easier idea, or more fun, or more relevant, as I'm driving around, usually with another inspector who I can bounce ideas off, is what could you do that would be a story set in these woods that would be, you know, skullduggery, a whodunit, and you can't solve the problem until you understand the organic certification process. Right. And so that got my brain turning.
Well, there you were. You're in the story. You're the female inspector. There is romance, by the way.
A little bit, but...
And you've got your trusty...
Very, very English. Very, very...
Very,
you know,
very demure.
Nothing nasty.
Nothing nasty, not at all. Just right.
Yes, that's right.
But, and you've got the pit bull, who might as well be a chihuahua. He's so cute and wonderful.
Yes.
And the story itself, it revolves around understanding how the process works, because it's not a... it's a subtle crime. The
yes.
core, I mean, there's a murder. Or
It looks like an accident.
It turns out to be a murder, but the motivation for the murder is based on a pretty subtle crime in the sense of how the cheating was going on that was going to be revealed by the victim.
Yes.
Yeah. How do I get a copy?
How do you get a copy?
How do I get a copy?
Well, the best way is to go to your local independent bookstore. And I hope I think all of the nice independent bookstores that I know, I think I know them all. Certainly all the ones around here all carry the book and restock regularly. If they are out, they'll get it for you. Also, all the best gift shops. We sell lots of books. I sell with a couple of friends who've got similar interest in the Northern Forest. So some of the really nice gift shops that carry books. Mm. If that fails, the next easy step is to go to the publisher's catalogue. Main Authors Publishing.
That's it.
Another whole topic. In Thomaston, they have an excellent online catalogue and a very efficient and prompt ordering system. You can buy direct from them or from my website, claireackroyd.com.
So what's next?
Oh, I'm 99%. I have to pick the brains one more time of a game warden to make sure I don't embarrass myself with the ending. But I've got The Body in the Blueberry Barrens almost ready because, don't get me started. The wild blueberries in Maine are as peculiar and as iconic and as specific to their landscape as the maple trees are.
Next, well, there have been lobster ones already, we know that, but potatoes.
Well, potatoes, but you see the difference, think about this, the difference between potatoes and blueberries and the difference between blueberries and maple and almost any other crop in the world, with one or two very small exceptions, is that they are not planted crops. Potatoes are planted, corn is planted, beef is basically planted. It's more like lobsters. You have to go where they are. Fish now are becoming farmed, and lobsters probably soon will be. The wild blueberries, which you can argue that they're not wild anymore, and the maple syrup are two of the very few agricultural products of any significance that are not planted. You have to go where the thing grows to get it. I'm told that Brazil nuts is another one. I don't know much about Brazil nut production, but there are very few things that have any significance on the international scene that are harvested where they grow.
Is there a future in the certification process? I mean, it will continue. You say that there are regulations in the state or standards in the state, but there's no conformity between standards in Vermont or New Hampshire. No,
there's conformity. Yeah. It's just that I think, and again, I hope I'm not wrong on this, because I think it's a changing scene. The maple syrup, because it's a very small crop nationally, when the National Organic Program produced its rules and regulations for all of the major crops, most of which fall under one umbrella, you know, row crops and tree crops and things all have their own sets of standards. Maple was not considered, and the states have come up with their own, which are aligned with the national program, but I don't think they are formally adopted. And again, I could be deadly wrong about that, and I apologize to Mofka and the NOP if I'm wrong. But that's a difference without a significance. They are essentially the same, and they all align. So the future of it, people are fighting over... It's a complicated process. Way back in the 70s, when I started talking about this with, I don't know if anybody knows Matt Liebman's name. He was the guy who came to the University of Maine and started the Sustainable Agriculture Program. He and his family were neighbors and friends. And I can remember having a conversation with Matt that says, what happens if this thing takes off? You know, be careful what you wish for. Organic certification, organic production in those days was tiny operations. And now it's huge. And the science behind it has come such a long way. This is not your grandfather's production system. This is highly technical, very scientifically based, extremely thoughtful ways of producing food. So it also makes the premium on organic production. And it's also more expensive to do. So there are areas of agriculture where big producers are trying to get in on the organic label for money. And they apply pressure to the system to make exceptions. Does my dairy cow really have to go out on grass every day? Can I really not spray this? Can I really not harvest close to the this and that? And all of those things are constantly under pressure. And I think the organic world is doing a very good job of fighting back. One of the inevitable results of that is that the regulations tighten. And what used to be it looks good to me, becomes you've got to prove it and document it and test it. And that becomes very onerous to some producers. And there are people who are dropping out of organic certification because either they don't like what gets permitted because of the pressures to allow, you know, this wormer on an adult cow should be, I don't know, that's a bad example because that's not allowed. But, you know, there are things that the purists don't like. And then there are things that the people trying to seriously make a living find impossible to comply with and still be profitable. So there are side ventures. There's different certifications now developing that try to take care of that. But I don't think that we should be worrying about that, certainly not at the moment. I think the organic certification process is alive and well, and it has become mainstream. I mean, look at the big stores now, and look at all the products that are certified organic. And I think there's a great deal of reason to trust the organic certification process.
How long are we going to keep doing this? How many more trips on the Golden Road?
Well, I have to admit, I'm aging out of the process. I didn't do maple inspections this year. I think, did I do? I haven't done those big camps in 2 years. And I would still, if I go with somebody young enough and strong enough and a decent vehicle, I'm useful because I can speak French. And I know my way around the system. But it's exhausting. And I'm getting old.
And well, that's time for an apprentice program.
Well, there are those. Then there are very, very good people coming into the system doing inspections. Right. The trouble, of course, is that a lot of people coming into it can't find 3 or 4 days back to back to leave a farm, a family, another job, to go up and stick yourself in the woods on the Canadian border. But it's hard work. You have to start fairly early to get into the woods in time that you can get a couple of inspections done. And because it's hard to get to, and you tend to try to get too many done in one day, and then you get back and you're tired and hungry and cold and wet, and you have some food, and then you've got 3 reports to write. And each one of those, and if you don't write them the day you do them, you forget which one had the wrong size taps, who had pulled taps too late, who hadn't labeled their barrels properly, and with all the notes that you make. And so it's 11 o'clock before you go to bed and get up again at 6 in the morning to start. And that's tough.
Claire, this has been absolutely fascinating.
I mean, as you could probably guess, we could talk for another five hours.
You are voluble, that's true, but that's great. That makes it very easy.
Well, it's an interesting topic.
It totally is. Just, thank you very much, and keep at it.
I thank you.
My guest today has been Claire Aykroyd, first-time novelist, inspector of maple syrup production, historian of a time, place, symbol, and reality of a major natural resource unique to a region, but oh so familiar to our taste of things, especially Maine. The program is Conversations from the Pointed Firs, a monthly interview program, the first Friday every month here on WERU Community Radio. This has been Conversations from the Pointed Firs. I'm Peter Neal. Thanks for listening.